This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, the federal government's injecting $2 billion into a fund to help small businesses grow. The federal treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, is my guest. And sexual harassment. A new survey shows just how shockingly common it is in our workplaces.
That sinking feeling in your chest where you just, you know, it's going to happen to you again, but you can't do anything about it. Well, I thought I couldn't do anything about it.
Scott Morrison will today attend his first international summit as Prime Minister at the ASEAN and East Asia Summit in Singapore, and he's certainly set himself a challenge, seeking to mop up a diplomatic row of his own making. Indonesia remains angry at Mr. Morrison's idea of moving the Australian embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. And it seems the much-anticipated trade deal between the two nations is being held up until the matter is resolved. Southeast Asia correspondent David Lipson filed this report from Singapore.
Scott Morrison had been hoping his first international summit as Prime Minister would come with a juicy windfall, the signing of the much-anticipated free trade deal with Indonesia. Now the PM's best hope is merely stopping the agreement withering on the vine.
When everybody's ready, it will be signed.
That's Trade Minister Simon Birmingham. He met his Indonesian counterpart in Singapore yesterday before revealing the timeline for inking the agreement now stretches toward April next year, when Indonesia holds its presidential elections.
We want to see it signed. Indonesia wants to see it signed. I'm confident that we will see it signed before then.
The two countries reached agreement in August, but Indonesia has made clear the one thing standing in the way is Scott Morrison's talk of moving Australia's embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, seen as a slap in the face for Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation and a strong supporter of the Palestinian people. Scott Morrison promised to discuss the matter with world leaders at the upcoming summits before making a final decision. Senator Birmingham again.
Between conclusion of negotiations and signing of the China agreement, it took around 7 months. We're well within that type of window in terms of our discussions with Indonesia.
It's not the only trade deal to have hit a speed bump. Hoping to stave off protectionist sentiments led by the US, world leaders were hoping to progress the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. If sealed, it would cover half the world's population, a third of its GDP, with China, Japan, South Korea, India and Australia among the countries included, but notably not the United States. Professor of International Affairs and Dean of the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University, Michael Wesley, says hopes of clinching a deal in Singapore have been dashed.
We saw last week the talks in Singapore failed to reach a substantive conclusion, as was promised at the start of the year. Ministers say that there has been substantial progress made, but there is still quite a few hurdles to be cleared based on the fact that there are such a wide range of levels of development and economic models across the group of countries that the trade agreement would eventually cover.
Achieving free trade in 2018 is taking quite a toll. This is David Lipson in Singapore for AM.
It is the so-called summit season. There'll also be the APEC summit in Port Moresby on the weekend. Mr. Morrison will be at that meeting, so too the Chinese President Xi Jinping, where he's expected to offer increased Chinese aid to Pacific nations. China's warned of a Cold War mentality in the Pacific in an apparent rebuke of Mr. Morrison's pledge to lift Australia's defence and aid ties in the region. The former Labor Foreign Minister, Bob Carr, accused the federal government of driving Pacific allies into the arms of China after offensive comments reportedly made by the Environment Minister last month to the former president of Kiribati. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra.
Australia's recently unveiled pivot to the Pacific has caught Beijing's eye, and it doesn't like what it sees. This is Vice Foreign Minister Zheng Zeguang speaking through a translator.
The Pacific Island region is not a sphere of influence of any country, and we hope that the relevant sides would actively, positively and objectively look at the relations between China and the Pacific Island countries and to abandon Cold War mentality.
Former Labor Foreign Minister Bob Carr, who now heads the Australia-China Relations Institute, is also urging a less confrontational approach.
One option for us is to work with China to say, let's get some joint projects going.
And he says China's position in the Pacific was strengthened by recent reported comments from Environment Minister Melissa Price to the former president of Kiribati, Anote Tong. It was reported she accused the Nobel Prize nominee of looking for cash and joked she had her checkbook at the ready.
We run the risk the leadership of one of these small island developing states, faced with rudeness or ignorance from Australia, is going to say, well, look, you don't want us to take aid from China, we might as well do it.
In the lead-up to APEC, Scott Morrison's promised a reset with Australia's Pacific neighbours as a bulwark against rising Chinese influence in the region. Hugh White recently retired as Professor of Strategic Studies at Australian National University.
The government has raised very high expectations, particularly amongst the South Pacific countries, that they're going to see a whole new sort of generation of Australian largesse. I don't get the impression the government's got many details to offer them.
Canberra's already pledged to help develop a new naval base on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island.
It's quite symbolically significant, but that symbol's got to be given some substance. And if we're prepared, for example, to really undertake to Papua New Guinea and the Solomons and Vanuatu and the other countries close to us, East Timor, that if they face serious aggression, we are willing to defend them, that would start to have an impact. But that would be a big thing for Australia to say, and then we'd have to have the means to back it up.
The immediate priority, he says, is building on the strong historical links with the region and adopting a more respectful tone.
These are small and fragile countries. They can be hard to help. And so I think it's going to be something much more sophisticated than just turning up with a slightly bigger checkbook than China. Partly because China's checkbook is very big, and partly because just spending money isn't actually what it's about.
And that's ANU Professor Hugh White ending that report from Tom Eagledon. The federal government's announcing today that it's injecting $2 billion into a new small business securitisation fund to help small businesses get money to expand their enterprises. Often when small businesses want loans, big banks will only give them the money if they use their own personal homes as security. Seems this fund will be available only to small banks and lenders who will then on-loan the money to small business operators. It'll also provide more competition with the big banks. Joining us now to explain why is the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. Welcome back to AM.
Nice to be with you, Sabra.
Is this one of the side effects of the Royal Commission that in the spotlight of the inquiry, big banks have tightened up their lending to small businesses, further creating a credit squeeze?
Well, it is certainly true that in the context of the Royal Commission, we have seen some tighter lending from the big banks, but small businesses do it tough when it comes to access to finance because often they are asked to put up their own home as collateral. And the rates that they pay are often higher than what a borrower would pay on a normal home loan. So we want to bridge that gap, which the Productivity Commission has said could be up to 4 percentage points. We want to increase the liquidity in the market, increase the competition for the big banks by entering into the securitisation market, which, dare I say, governments have done before when it comes to residential mortgages back in 2008 in the context of the GFC.
Have you been in touch with the big bank CEOs to urge them to cut a better deal for small businesses?
I certainly have made my views very public over the course
of
the weekend.
Have you talked with them?
I have, and I have talked to them about the importance of ensuring that their loan books remain open, that they remain very conscious of the public good where access to finance is available. And I have to say, Australia hasn't had the experience that the United States has had with the Fannie Mae and the Freddie Macs, where loans were given to people who couldn't afford to meet the servicing costs. We've had a very different experience here where we haven't had the bad loans that you've seen in the United States.
We've seen in the Royal Commission where banks have lent to small businesses, especially for people buying franchises, and some of those cases have ended really badly and the banks have been criticised for that. Is it understandable that banks are being so cautious?
Well, banks have to get the balance right. Of course, they need the right documentation. They need to be very conscious that people can service their loans. But they also need to be aware that small businesses are the engine room of the economy. More than 3 million small businesses across Australia are responsible for around 70% of total private sector employment. So we need to continue to ensure that the banks' books are kept open, that access to finance is maintained, and it is affordable. And this is where the government's $2 billion securitisation fund can make a real difference.
But by setting up this securitisation fund, implicit in that, you're saying that the big banks haven't got the balance right.
Well, I'm saying we need more competition. We have a very underdeveloped securitisation market for small business loans, particularly unsecured loans, whereas in contrast we have quite a developed residential mortgage-backed securitisation market. So we do need to see governments play a role here. We do believe we can do so in a way that doesn't risk our balance sheet, and we will use the Australian Office of Financial Management, which have experience in this regard, particularly in the residential mortgage-backed market back
but
in
it isn't,
2008.
But it is another government intervention. By providing this $2 billion fund, you're effectively guaranteeing these loans. If they go sour, the banks won't be exposed to the loans. It'll be the taxpayer.
Well, the taxpayer's risk will be very carefully managed with sufficient due diligence, and obviously AOFM, the Office of Financial Management, working closely with the rating agencies, and they have a lot of experience in this regard. So I'm confident that they'll get the balance right. We'll be looking for the best quality debt available, and we'll be ensuring that some of these smaller lenders and the smaller banks that are not in the big four get an opportunity to compete with lower cost of capital and therefore lower interest rates that they can offer their customers.
How many businesses does the government anticipate will take advantage of this? And is there any modelling on how many extra jobs will come from it?
Well, let's wait and see how many businesses take it up.
Have you done any modelling?
Well, what we have done, obviously, with Treasury is they've looked very closely at this particular proposal, and it will be important in generating more confidence in the sector. We've talked to the stakeholders about it. In terms of the job creation, well, as I say, small business is absolutely critical. And if they don't have access to finance, then they can't create more jobs. That's why we're doing it.
All right. I'd like to quickly run through some other issues. Woodside Energy says it's time for the government to impose a carbon price. Will you heed that call?
No. We believe that we need to get prices down, and the best way to do that is without the carbon tax that the Labor Party is again proposing. The best way to do that is to follow through on the recommendations of the ACCC to put in place a standard price from which the energy companies can discount to ensure that we get more generation into the market by standing behind new providers that are outside the big three energy companies, particularly for industrial customers.
Sure, but Peter Coleman,
they're the things that we're doing.
Peter Coleman has been very critical of the debate that's been happening within the government, saying that if we reduce the debate on climate change to a showdown between coal and renewables, we lose sight of the options for a more balanced approach.
Well, we're not saying it's coal versus renewables. We're actually saying it's an all-of-the-above strategy and that you can't be ideological about it, whereas the Labor Party are very happy to turn their
back. Sorry, and have you told the rump of the right within the coalition?
Well, look, I'll leave that sort of commentary and that partisanship to you, Sabra. What I'm saying is that we as a party are not being technology specific. What we're saying is we need an all of the above approach, which sees a role for thermal generation, particularly coal and the gas that Woodside is renowned for, as well as renewables, which have increased more on the coalition's watch than they ever did under Labor.
Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, thanks for joining the program this morning.
Always good to be with you.
You're listening to AM, where it's 13 minutes past 8. More than 2 years after Britain voted to leave the European Union, a draft Brexit agreement has emerged with the British Cabinet to meet soon to consider its details. And already, it's set off another round of bloodletting within Theresa May's government. Europe correspondent Linton Besser reports.
It's taken 2 years, it's still only in draft form, and it's yet to be publicly examined. But the UK-Europe Brexit deal is already being dismissed by the UK government's hard rump of Brexiteers. Leading the rebellion is the former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson.
It will mean that we are having to accept rules and regulations from Brussels over which we have no say ourselves.
The wording of the agreement was hammered out by technical advisers to both London and Brussels, who have been working in utter secrecy for months. Now, finally, Theresa May's cabinet ministers are being shown what they've come up with in a series of one-on-one briefings at No. 10 Downing Street.
Is there a deal, Mr. Hancock?
The June 2016 referendum has thrown the United Kingdom into political chaos and threatened to drag the British economy into the doldrums. But the greatest sticking point has been the future of Ireland, where the EU has its only hard border with the United Kingdom. Mrs. May has tried to solve this dilemma by proposing a common rulebook with the EU for customs declarations and tax requirements. But members of her own party have castigated her proposal, and they came out swinging as news of the deal broke.
I think that the issue of the border in Northern Ireland has been escalated quite deliberately in order to produce this perverse result that the whole of the UK ends up remaining within the customs union and in the single market, thereby effectively frustrating the result of the referendum and the verdict of the people.
Conservative MP and arch-Brexiteer Jacob Rees-Mogg said the draft agreement would see the UK sacrifice its own sovereignty.
Well, if what we've heard is true, this fails to meet the Conservative Party's manifesto, and it fails to meet many of the commitments that the Prime Minister makes. It would keep us in the customs union and de facto in the single market. It is a failure to deliver on Brexit.
The final wording of the withdrawal agreement has been reported to contain 400 pages of dense legal text. If Cabinet signs off on the deal, the European Union is due to hold a Brexit summit on November 25, with the British Parliament then to be asked to ratify the agreement. It's a big if for a Prime Minister who is only just keeping a grip on her government. This is Linton Besser in London for AM.
Back home now, and the Me Too movement has put a spotlight on sexual harassment in the high-profile industries of acting, media and politics. But it happens in other workplaces too. In fact, 61% of women and 35% of men who've responded to a trade union movement survey say they've experienced harassment at work. Eliza Borrello reports.
It's been a year since a Perth woman we'll call Sophie was sexually harassed at work. Over the course of 2 years, the young vet was repeatedly harassed by her boss, a vet roughly 30 years her senior.
Comments on, you know, breast size, who I was sleeping with, those sorts of things. There's no, I don't know, great standout. He used to pretend to try to get into the change room with me, pretend to open the door and things like that.
She describes freezing when she'd find herself in a room with him unexpectedly.
That sinking feeling in your chest where, yeah, you just, you know, it's going to happen to you again, but you can't do anything about it. Well, I thought I couldn't do anything about it.
Sophie did eventually make a complaint after her boss terminated her employment without giving a reason.
It was at that point that all of it, you know, my world came crashing down. That was the job that I dedicated my life to, and I had a lot of encouragement from a lot of people around me, which is probably the only reason I went through with it.
The Australian Council of Trade Unions is running an online survey about sexual harassment. So far, more than 7,500 people have responded. More than 60% of the women who completed it say they've been sexually harassed at work, and 35% of the men. Of the women, fewer than one in two reported the incident, something that doesn't surprise Jessica Smith, one of the principal lawyers at Perth's Employment Law Centre.
I think the initial concern of many women who experience sexual harassment is getting out of the situation rather than reporting it.
Her best advice, which she cautions is of a general nature, is to act quickly if you do want to make a complaint.
Nationally, the Australian Human Rights Commission, and you've only got about 6 months to make a complaint from the date that the harassment occurred. There may be other state and territory tribunals that you can make a complaint to, and they might have different time limits, but either way, it's important to look into your options early so that you don't miss out on the opportunity to make a complaint if that's what you wish to do.
As for Sophie, she made a workers' compensation claim against her former boss for emotional distress causing severe depression. She also formally complained about her pay and working conditions and the sexual harassment. She's now been awarded more than $100,000.
Eliza Borrello reporting. The ACTU's president is Michelle O'Neill, and she joined me earlier. Welcome to AM.
Thanks, Sabra.
Your surveys found that one in two women report sexual harassment at work and that 40% of victims don't report it. Why don't they?
Well, we think there's a problem with women not being convinced that they're going to get swift access to justice. They're worried they're not going to be believed, not confident that there's going to be systems in place that are going to deal with their complaint confidentially and that there's going to be a result that satisfies them. So I think you see a silencing of women and people who are experiencing sexual harassment across every level of the workforce.
Might it be an overrepresentation of the real numbers, given that the survey is a self-reporting online questionnaire?
Look, it is self-reporting, but what we've been overwhelmed by is how swift the response to it has been. We opened this in the middle of September. We've had 7,500 people respond to the survey, and it's consistent with the sort of figures that the Human Rights Commission is also finding in their research as part of the inquiry into sexual harassment at work. So, yes, it is people self-reporting, but the fact that so many people have made the effort to go online, fill in the survey and respond across the country and across every part of the workforce, I think is alarming and is a wake-up call.
Women who experience this might not want to bring a complaint because they don't want the perpetrator to lose their job or they think it's too trivial. In those circumstances, what's your advice? How should they deal with it?
What women need to know is that they can speak to someone confidentially and get advice. Obviously, we think that this is something that the union movement is very experienced as, and so being able to speak to a delegate or a confidential health and safety rep in the workplace and say, this is what is happening, what should I do, makes a big difference. Also having procedures in place where it's clear who is meant to manage the complaint at the employer level. So again, it may be that the person who's experienced harassment wants the person who's done it to be spoken to. But if they're not confident, they're even going to be disciplined and spoken to and told, that's it, you better not behave in that way again, in a very trivial or small manner. None of this is trivial in the sense that it's often a pattern of behaviour. If one woman's experience, it's really common that other women have had the same problem with the same person. So we need to have workplace laws that show that there is a serious consequence and that if behaviour isn't stopped at the very beginning, or in fact, of course, the best outcome is prevented, then there will be consequences for the people that perpetrate this.
As you point out, there are already laws dealing with sexual harassment. Are you proposing higher penalties?
We're proposing a change so that there's the capacity for workplace laws, the Fair Work Commission, to have a role around sexual harassment as well. So that laws to deal with all other types of workplace laws, things like your rosters, your hours, your pay, should also be able to deal with complaints to do with sexual harassment. We also want to see changes to health and safety laws. And we also want, I suppose, the capacity for the Fair Work Commission to have some better expertise, because we think the rise in insecure work is actually contributing to the problem with sexual harassment.
The Human Rights Commission is currently conducting a broad inquiry on this issue, including its own survey work. It will come up with recommendations for the government. How much faith do you have in that process?
So we want to make sure that the Human Rights Commission is fully resourced to do the extent of the inquiry that they need to do.
So how much do you think more money, more staff?
I think there needs to be more resources, more money and staff to it. But I also think that it's important that the inquiry is being done. We welcome that they're doing it. But to be able to make sure they get to the bottom of this huge problem, we don't want it cut short and we don't want it under-resourced. The other issue, of course, is that there's a problem at the moment in the Human Rights Commission powers, in that, as you saw in previous Royal Commissions, if people had signed a settlement agreement, there's often a confidentiality clause. So we're concerned that women who have experienced sexual harassment but may have had been involved in some sort of settlement of it are again being silenced, and that the Human Rights Commission needs similar powers to be able to hear from those women.
Thanks for joining AM.
Thanks, Sarah.
The ACTU President Michelle O'Neill. At least 1 million Australians could be saving hundreds of dollars on their power bills just by switching to a more competitive deal. That's according to a new analysis that highlights the big difference between standing offers and the more competitive market offers some retailers are offering. The annual tariff tracking report claims some people could be saving up to $1,000 a year. Here's National Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge.
Sydney retiree Marinda Eyre has been closely tracking her energy costs to keep her bills down, but she says it's still hard to know if she's on the best deal.
My current provider gives me one price, but that covers everything I use. But others give me peak, shoulder, off peak. And I find that somewhat disconcerting.
The Tariff Tracking Report has been monitoring energy prices for a decade. And this year it says the energy market has become opaque and frustrating for consumers. This has led to many people languishing on more expensive standing offers instead of negotiating a cheaper market offer with their retailer or a competitor. Gavin Dufty from St Vincent de Paul Society is the report's co-author.
At the extreme, depending on where you are, you know, there's $1,000 on the table there. It is a lot. Probably more modest and average sort of price. If you haven't shopped around in the market, there's $600 easy waiting for you.
The Tariff Tracking Project started in Victoria and now includes New South Wales, South Australia, Tasmania, the ACT and Queensland. The projected savings don't cover Tasmania and the ACT, where prices are set by regulators. Across the six jurisdictions, electricity prices have gone up 75% in 10 years. South Australia's have gone up the most at 112%, while Victoria's prices have gone up 104% in the decade. Gavin Dufty says those states have experienced issues including rising network costs and an increase in the wholesale cost of electricity with coal-fired power plants shutting down.
People might be on market contracts or not on market contracts. You'll have some households on solar and of course different consumption levels and different tariffs.
Last month, Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced the government wanted to end confusion and proposed setting a base or default price for power in each jurisdiction. Another option is setting a comparator rate so households could compare their bill with the average cost for a similar household in a similar area. Sarah McNamara from the Australian Energy Council says the industry is working hard to make it simpler for consumers.
There are already good deals in the marketplace today, and we want to encourage consumers not to wait for reforms to be completed, but to get on the phone to their retailer or get onto the government comparator site and choose the best deal for their circumstances.
And that's the Australian Energy Council's Sarah McNamara ending that report from Amy Bainbridge. New research has depicted a bleak future for all life on Earth if extreme environmental change takes place. Published in the journal Scientific Reports, the study says a global temperature rise of 5 to 6 degrees could be enough to wipe out all animal species. Louise Creeley has the story.
An extinction domino effect. That's what could annihilate all life on Earth, according to new research. And scientists from Flinders University and the European Commission's Joint Research Centre in Italy say it should make humans less optimistic about the impact of future climate change. Professor Corey Bradshaw is the Matthew Flinders Fellow in Global Ecology and co-lead author of the report.
We created this pretend planet, linking up all of these species based on real data. And then we slowly heated these virtual Earths, or we slowly cooled them. And as species exceeded their temperature tolerances and then went extinct, then all the dependent species that were connected to them then went extinct in a cascade. And these are called co-extinctions. The predicted amount of extinctions from any value of climate change, whether that be increasing temperature or decreasing temperature, underestimates the total number of extinctions by up to 10 times.
Professor Bradshaw says in their virtual Earth model, a warming of 5 to 6 degrees was enough to wipe out every type of species on the planet.
Incidentally, that actually seems to match some of the conditions we saw in the geological record, suggesting that planetary warming of, 5-6 degrees caused most of the species on the planet at that time to go extinct.
Professor Brendan Wintle from the University of Melbourne is the director of the Threatened Species Recovery Hub, a national research organisation. He says Australia is one of the worst offenders when it comes to biodiversity loss.
We have 1,800 species on our list in Australia that are at risk of extinction. And so the decline in status of species moving onto that list of being at high risk of extinction, that gives us the second worst rate of biodiversity loss on the planet, behind Indonesia and, as I said, the worst in the developed world.
While the climate change response needs to eventually be a global one, scientists say there's more Australia can do on its own to tackle the other main drivers of extinction, habitat loss and the impact of feral animals. Professor Wintle says it's known what needs to be done and now the government must act on the research.
But it costs money. So we need to spend money to actually save species.
That's Professor Brendan Wintle, the director of the Threatened Species Recovery Hub, ending Louise Creeley's report. We approached the Environment Minister, Melissa Price, for comment, but haven't received a response as yet. Checking finance, Wall Street's lower after a steep fall in crude oil prices hammered energy stocks. The price of West Texas crude has dropped 6% to $56.20 a barrel. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has closed down 0.4%. And the Australian dollar is higher this morning. It's just under 72 US cents. That is AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It is 8:30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.